Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. When we go online, a main goal is to get informed and connect with others. It's a tool often at our fingertips that has the capacity to benefit our lives. And it does. But there's also a lot of room for the information we take in and engage with to be harmful. As we all know, just because it's posted online doesn't make it true, but it can be hard to use that critical lens when emotions are high and issues are complicated. The fast pace of online and social media coverage creates room for error and also an opportunity to take advantage. The most recent largest display of misinformation and disinformation online can be found with the Israel-Hamas war. How we view the atrocities on innocent lives in Gaza and Israel can hinge greatly on where we're getting our information from. And with such an uncertain and quickly developing conflict, even trusted sources of news have publicly taken a hard look at their own coverage with the goal to improve. We're going to get a lesson in how to have productive conversations without confrontation and leave with some tools about what to trust, share, and act on. John Silva is with the News Literacy Project, an organization that works to dismantle misinformation tactics and trends, as well as connect people to the best practices to find credible sources. Welcome, John.
Good morning, Vicky. It's a pleasure to be here again.
It's nice to have you. I mean, you've joined us a couple times over the years. The first time you joined us was exactly 2 years ago. It was in October of 2021, and we talked broadly back then about misinformation. I mean, phrases that are now pretty common, vernacular, like fake news or alternative facts. And we were coming off of the 2020 election, the January 6th insurrection, of course, the pandemic. And I just think about all that has happened in the time since you first joined us. How has your work evolved in that time?
You're right. There seems to be a never-ending parade of topics where misinformation, unfortunately, becomes a major issue. As we have been doing our work for the last many years, we have been thinking about new and important strategies, not only for our primary work of working with educators to teach young people about credible sources of news and information, but we're working with what we're calling civic learning, trying to work with adults to understand just how difficult it can be to find and prioritize those credible sources.
Given that this organization, the News Literacy Project, I mean, it was founded back in 2008, you know, so that's more than a decade ago. I would imagine when you're talking about that civic engagement, that the awareness of misinformation and disinformation, it's evolved greatly since this nonprofit was founded 15 years ago.
Oh, it's evolved significantly. You know, when Alan Miller first founded this, it was really a smaller operation focused on teaching young people about quality journalism, focused on where to get your news and current events. And, you know, especially since about the 2016 election, this has taken on a much larger national urgency in many different ways.
Can you remind us of the difference between misinformation and disinformation?
Sure. So disinformation is anything that is intentionally and knowingly created to be false, with the intention of trying to make people believe that it's true, right? So if I make something up and I spread it online and I'm hoping people think it's real, that's disinformation. Once someone sees it, if they think it's real and they spread it, then it becomes misinformation. Misinformation is a much broader definition that way.
Going back to when this nonprofit was founded in 2008, I mean, the online digital landscape looked completely different than what it looks like now. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have social media apps now that evolved greatly just in the last couple of years to use these algorithms that cater to an individual user. But can you explain how this has shaped how or even if we have access to reliable sources and even different viewpoints?
I think with the incredible prevalence of social media, but just in general, information that's online, there are so many more authoring tools that people can easily learn how to use. So an individual can create their own website, their own podcast. You know, there's very little technical know-how sometimes that you would need to go in to be able to create and publish your own information. And social media allows us to be able to share those viewpoints with as wide an audience as we can reach. And that's, I think, one of the big difficulties is that we see social media as, you know, being in some ways responsible for the spread of misinformation, but while there are a lot of things that platforms could be doing better, there's also a lot that we as individuals can should be thinking about in terms of our own behaviors and how we use social media to interact with one another.
Do you get frustrated when you go on social media apps?
Yes, I do a lot actually. I try not to go on social media too much in my off hours because I do spend so much time on it during work. But I think one of the more frustrating things that happens is sometimes when I see people I know sharing false information, especially people that I know well. And I'm like, I want to say, like, you should know better. We've talked about this.
Yeah, I can relate and understand that. Yeah, and I think at the root of this, I mean, a big piece is, we're human. We have hearts. It's hard not to get swept up in emotions, especially when we're taking in terrible moments in history, from war to how nations respond to natural disasters, protest over human rights. I mean, there are too many to list. When you go on social media, how do you navigate these apps during these really tough and emotional moments?
The most important thing that I recommend to people is the importance of just slowing down. When we are deeply invested in a topic, a breaking news event, any of those things that you mentioned, when we are going on and we are trying to find out what's happening, we tend to approach it through this emotional connection. And when we are processing information emotionally, it is far easier for misleading and false information to manipulate us into believing that it's true. So especially during breaking news situations, especially thing issues where lots of people are talking about it, that's when we need to pause and wait and try to think, okay, where can I get credible information instead of where can I get any information? That's an important distinction to make when you're trying to find out what's going on.
Yeah. And I think the most recent example is, what's happening in Israel and Gaza, with Hamas conducting coordinated attacks and kidnappings on Israel. It hasn't even been 3 weeks. But then with the response of Israeli airstrikes on Gaza, more than 5,300 people in Gaza have been killed and some 1,400 in Israel. And that's according to the United Nations. And in that time, in less than 3 weeks, we're inundated with an abyss of images and information online. And that can make it really difficult to sift through fact and fiction. What stands out to you about the information you're seeing online?
I think when we're talking about the conflict in Israel currently, we have an incredibly complex web of sort of different groups of people with different perspectives, all trying to push their particular viewpoint of what's happening. We have people, you have cultural connections, family connections, there's political issues, there's religious issues. And so you have people on both sides of the conflict, to oversimplify, both sides of the conflict, who are trying to push their own interpretation of things, their own views about the war. But also in that, you have this array of social media trolls, people who are just trying to make things worse simply because they can. And so people are creating all manner of misinformation and disinformation, using old video clips, even footage from like video games to AI generated imagery to just make this even more difficult to navigate because it is there are so many sources, so many people are trying to manipulate this to push the narrative to further their own views on these goals. And in that, what we're also struggling with is there aren't enough journalists on the ground who are able to report on this to tell us, from a journalistic perspective, things that have been verified and credible information. And so it is so overwhelmingly complicated. It even kind of breaks my brain a little bit.
Yeah, and the pace is just so fast, and especially when it's online or on social media, because there's even been instances of, reputable sources taking a hard look at their own coverage. Yesterday, the New York Times posted a long editorial note upon reflection that they would have taken more precautions with its early coverage of an explosion at a hospital in Gaza. A CNN reporter, I believe last week, issued an online apology about their reporting live on the ground in the heat of the moment, taking a hard look with hindsight. So there's also these unintentional missteps from what have historically have been trusted media sources. That just makes it even more complicated.
It is, but I think there's a very important thing we all have to remember with the, I think the New York Times is a great example of that. News organizations, journalists, they get it wrong sometimes, despite all their best efforts, despite all the checks and balances. You know, they're trying to get it right, but sometimes things go wrong. And when a news organization issues a correction, or especially an editor's note, like the New York Times did, that's actually a sign of credibility that we try to teach people, right? Standards-based ethical news organizations will own their mistakes. They will hold themselves accountable, and they will tell people, look, we made a mistake. Here's how it happened, and here's what we know now. And here's what we're going to do going forward to try to make sure that doesn't happen again. So it's important to remember that mistakes happen, and the credible sources own it and acknowledge it.
Given that you also joined us a year and a half ago in February of 2022 to talk about misinformation during the initial Russian invasion of Ukraine, a war that continues today, do you see any parallels or even key differences?
I think there's a lot of parallels between the two events. You know, we could put up a long list of comparisons where similar misinformation tactics, similar style of propaganda coming out of different sources. And that's one of the things I think we need to kind of remember, is that the skills that we try to talk about with news literacy, it's not unique to any one world event, national event, politics, what have you. The skills are really about understanding the information that's coming at you. How do we slow down? How do we evaluate sources? How do we determine if a news source is credible? And how can we check things for ourselves before we share it online?
In the 15 years that this organization has been around, I mean, you've seen it evolve. What gives you faith that news literacy education will prevail when the information landscape is already complex and it's going to likely continue? I mean, I think about AI.
AI there's a lot of scary things about AI when we talk about misinformation. But I think what gets me at my desk every morning continuing this work is the fact that more and more educators are showing interest in integrating news literacy into their curriculum. Whether it's using our resources or using from other organizations, more and more educators are taking interest in making this a priority. And we've also seen a number of states who are starting to implement these types of things into their state standards. New Jersey is a recent example that they call it information literacy. So it's a requirement. And here where I live in Illinois, media literacy and news literacy is built into both middle and high school state standards. And a number of states are looking at that as well. So more people are realizing just how important this is, and not just educators, but states' departments of education are seeing it as well.
You know, what I'm learning from you, because you have a wealth of information and tools online for educators, also just for the general public. And we have a link to that on our Insight page. But I think one of the biggest piece of the biggest tool we can take with us is just pausing before we have a knee-jerk reaction to what we see online.
It's so important. If we could just slow down and not let confirmation bias manipulate us into believing something, then we can slow down the emotional response and then maybe proceed with a more careful, critical response.
The comment section also can be harmful. You know, people can easily, you know, make a comment or respond to a comment on a post. I mean, so let's just say we have the capacity in that moment to take a breath and pause. What should we consider? What should we weigh when it comes to whether we should even comment or post in the first place?
Well, I think if we see someone has posted something false online, I think the most important thing first is how important is it to me to correct this person in particular, right? You know, there are people posting all over the place. And so I often caution people, don't get into fights with strangers on the internet. But if you're going to engage, we have an acronym that we call PEP. It stands for patience, empathy, and persistence. And the idea is that before you decide you're going to engage and talk, you're trying to talk to somebody about false information, you need to first recognize that they probably genuinely believe this is true. And so you have to approach this carefully in a way that's, I want to talk to you about this. I want to share information. I don't want to be confrontational. right? I don't want to call you names, and I want to present things in a way that where you can look at the information. Maybe we can talk about it together, and then keep at it, right? Keep at it and keep sharing things in a way that is calm and patient and non-confrontational. And usually, if you can do that, the person hopefully will be open to seeing what you have. And you might not get the best response out of them, but that's the best thing to remember. And I just want to say, this time last year, we were also talking about the upcoming holidays, right? There's going to be a lot of this is going to be a hot topic around a lot of tables in the next couple of months.
Yeah,
It's not, it's also
because what we take in online doesn't just exist online, it can
correct.
transfer to our relationships in real
Yeah.
life.
And so I think if we're talking about a group of people around the dinner table, it's also important to remember, do I do this in front of the whole family, or do I maybe take this person aside later and say, hey, can we talk about this a little bit? But again, don't be confrontational and be patient, because it may not happen right away.
John, thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure.
John Silva is with the News Literacy Project, a nonpartisan nonprofit that works to dismantle misinformation tactics and trends, as well as the best practices to find credible sources. Up next, it's that time of year where a good amount of high school students are thinking about college, but data shows that less than half of Sacramento County students have completed the requirements to attend a UC or a Cal State. We'll learn more about why, as well as the programs working to help teens attain their higher education goals. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.